So it's delightful to be here. I've never been in a place like this before. We biologists don't have this sort of thing. I think we did back in the early days of molecular genetics, back in the Cold Spring Harbor. The tradition was right, but those people were all physicists. So I think that's, we have a big lesson to learn that we've forgotten since biology has taken off, molecular biology has taken off. The idea that you come together for long term and discuss science is really fantastic. So I'm going to talk today about an area of research that grew out of our comparative genomics studies. And basically, we started out looking for, like everybody else in the universe, looking for the commonality between genomes when we started to align genome sequences, and started to get more interested as time went on in the things that are different between genomes, and especially between genomes that are fairly similar to each other, which tend to be very highly conserved in content and function. And I think you've heard, I've seen your roster of talks over the last few months, you've heard people talking about those parts of the genome and the gene regulatory mechanism in particular that are deeply conserved. And what I'm going to talk about is another side of the story, and that is portions of the gene regulatory machinery and gene regulatory networks that are under very high pressure to evolve quickly. And there are two components, obviously, to gene regulatory networks. One is the cis regulatory sequences, and those of, and whenever I go to give talks these days, and I'm usually talking to a room full of people who are interested in those. As a lot of people know, they're deeply conserved in a lot of, at least in some cases, and that's their conservation is one way to identify them in the genome because they're under constraint, evolutionary constraint, even though they're not coding. Right now, there are millions of people out there looking for SNPs and cis regulatory sequences, looking for those small changes in sequence that might make a big difference in terms of gene regulation. But there's another component that at least my colleagues, mostly in the comparative genomics field, tend to forget, and that's the transcription factors. And partly because transcription factors are mostly thought of as a part of the genome that are the most highly conserved. And I'm sure you've heard stories about really deeply conserved transcription factors like PAX6, which can turn on eye development and everything from flies to, or even simpler organisms than flies, and all the way up to humans. But there are at least 2,000 predicted transcription factor genes in the human genome, and we only know the functions and the binding properties for about 400 of them. Those we know not necessarily very well. So this is really an unknown and unexplored part of the genome, believe it or not. I have a lot of colleagues who are busy making models of transcription factor binding sites and regulatory regions based on transcription factor binding sites, and I think given our state of knowledge about the transcription factors in at least mammalian genomes, that's something that is going to be very difficult to do. So accurate, yeah. Yeah, they are predicted from motifs that are known to be DNA binding, like leucine-rich motifs, zinc fingers, and so forth. And if we really want to start to make accurate regulatory networks, we really need to know what a lot of them are doing. So most of these proteins are highly conserved, and in fact, transcription factors as a group are probably more highly conserved than many groups of proteins. But what I'm going to talk about is that there are a significant fraction of transcription factor genes, and in humans, as part of one specific class, that are evolving very quickly. So this is the particular family in mammalian genomes that is evolving quickly. It's called the Krupel-associated box zinc finger genes. Does anybody have a pointer? Ah, yes. Here we go. Thank you. So these are very nice modular structures which have DNA binding zinc fingers held in tandem arrays together, which are attached through what we call a spacer sequence, and which we think more or less functions just as a rope. To separate these two elements spatially, but hold them together. And a chromatin interaction domain called a Krupel-associated box. So the Kruppel-associated box is a very particular kind of interaction domain. It's found on just a subclass of the Kruppel-type family. So these are Kruppel-type zinc fingers. And Kruppel-type zinc fingers are in just about every eukaryotic genome. They're attached to various kinds of effector sequences in different lineages. In mammals, this is the most prevalent configuration for zinc fingers. So the DNA binding takes place in coordination with this zinc finger array. And the crab motif confers a really specific and highly potent DNA repressor or gene expression repressor activity through the recruitment of a cofactor, a universal cofactor called CAP1. What CAP1 does then is attract histone deacetylase complexes and basically shuts down the local region around where the zinc finger protein is bound. And this mechanism has been very well characterized by several people, including Frank Rauscher, who's really the main discoverer of the crab box. So if we look at this family in eukaryotes, what we can see are there are none. No crab plus zinc finger sequences in fish. As I said, the zinc fingers are there, but no proteins with this particular kind of configuration exist in fish. There are a few of them in amphibians, less than 50. There are quite a few more in birds. By the time we get to mammals, we have 400 proteins of this type, more or less. And all mammals have on the order of the same number of zinc finger proteins, and so, or crab zinc finger proteins. So somewhere back in evolutionary history, around the time of the tetrapod divergence, these two pieces of DNA came together and formed a type of protein that then became very, very useful and duplicated itself, made lots of copies of itself. And those copies have been maintained and held as functional genes in various mammalian genomes. Yeah. Yeah. So they have the same basic architecture, the crab plus repeats, but the number of repeats varies hugely, and I will talk a lot about that. So when we look in the human genome, and this is how we first got onto these genes, we were looking at the human genome, and we noticed that there were large clusters of repeated copies of these genes in clusters in the human genome. And when we looked over to the mouse genome, we found, for the most part, and as I'll say later, there are exceptions, lots of exceptions to this rule, but usually when you find a family in human, you'll find a family in mouse. And so we thought, aha, that's really great. We can move across. We can study their regulation and their functions using the mouse model system. But that was unfortunately not to be the case, or fortunately, depending on how you think about it. No, I think fortunately. So, for example, here's a cluster that we've studied very well, and it's a beautiful example of what we see when we go to look at all these clusters in the human and various mammalian genomes. So here's a cluster from human chromosome 19 mapped back to homologs and paralogs in the mouse genome. And what you see are these relationships of one human gene to many mouse genes, one mouse gene to many human genes, some one-to-one copies, and others that are just missing from one lineage. No trace of anything like that in the other lineage. So mouses, basically, rodents have basically lost some of these sequences. We know that they've lost them for various reasons that we could talk about, but because we now have the dog genome and so forth, we can see that sequences that were there ancestrally are just missing from the rodent genome. Even if we compare mouse and rat, we see big differences. So this particular sequence, which is a one-to-one homolog between mouse and human, has two copies in rat. And actually, if we look closely at the sequence, we can see that mouse used to have, or the lineage of mouse used to have two copies too and lost one. So there's a lot of not only gain through tandem duplication, but loss of these genes as well, probably through homologous recombination. And we see this in every cluster we look at. There are very few one-to-one relationships. Depends, because we see cases where this could have been a very ancient group where mouse just lost them, and we see other cases where these are more recent. These happen to be more recent copies, but not much more recent than, so for example, dog has most of these genes. So not all of them. There are some very recent human copies in here mixed with older ones. But a lot of this has probably been a combination of gene gain and loss in the different lineages. So this is going on wildly in every lineage we look at. And it's really, there are, as I'll talk about, there are some big expanded clusters of human genes that are obviously very new. They're obviously primate specific and everything in between. Some very, very old ones that are deeply conserved and some that are lost in one lineage and not the other. And I'll talk about some specific examples. So, So in addition to this differential duplication within the conserved clusters, every lineage has clusters that you don't see in any other. And so we've recently done a careful look at and cataloging and annotation of the human genes because we wanted to know which ones are genes, which ones are pseudogenes, how do they look, how are they related evolutionarily, how are they related functionally. And we've annotated 423 functional protein coding genes in the human genome. When we looked at the mouse genes and dog genes and so forth, only about 100 of those have one-to-one orthologs in mouse. So 300 of them don't recognize a mouse ortholog. They recognize potentially a mouse paralog, some of them. Some of them don't, definitely don't. About a third of the human genes of this type are specific to primates. Definitely have duplicated that recently. And you can tell that by looking at the duplicons and the similarity between the proteins. About 20 of them are specific just to hominids, so that's great apes and us. And you can tell that they're that recent just by looking at the structure of the duplicons. The history includes both gene duplication and gene loss in every combination in between. And every vertebrate genome also harbors lineage-specific clusters. And so there's a very large rodent-specific cluster in chromosome 13 where there's nothing like that in the human genome. They just have blossomed in the rodent genome. And in fact, mouse and rat really differ in these clusters. This is pretty much a mouse-specific cluster, so very, very recent duplication. There's also a cluster in chromosome 2 and chromosome 4, primate-specific clusters in at least three locations, smaller ones elsewhere. And we've recently been looking at the bird zinc finger genes. There's almost no homologs that go back to vertebrates. They have expanded their own. And in fact, most of the bird zinc finger genes of this type are recent duplicates and bird specific. mRNA, complete open reading frames, mostly mRNA. Most of them nobody has studied. We're starting to, when we go in and design antibodies to them, for example, we do see proteins. But that's the only, just the standard, they're functional, potentially functional genes that are transcribed. Yes. Yeah, and mostly they are. No, they're not somewhere else. What happens is you have these long tandem duplications that can align and they recombine out. You can see the evidence of that. It's kind of complicated how you can see the evidence of that, but if you look at the sequence, you can see bits left behind where there's been a recombination event. It's an illegitimate recombination event that has just looped out and deleted copies, or duplication happens the same way. You can see whole groups of genes that have been duplicated together through recombination events. Yes, we see translocations. Well, we see translocations, but we can track them in the genome. They're there, and we know where they are. But they usually go in groups. There are some cases where duplications have been sent out as singletons, and we can see those too. And that's an interesting new method for seeding new clusters that we've described in a paper that we published last year. So the question is, you've got all these four, lots of copies, and they're diverging wildly between the various genomes. So the question is, are they functional, and how are they differentiating themselves from each other? Are they just copies, or are they doing something different? And so we've been looking at how they diverge, and these new duplicates vary through two mechanisms. Some genes have done both things, and some have just done one or the other. So they duplicate, they diverge through expression patterns. So if you look at these genes, for example, this is that cluster I showed you from human chromosome 19, the human region with the big expansion of human genes, and this is the little cluster of human expanded genes that where mouse only had one. And these are some of them are fairly recent duplicates. And for example, look at this pair here. These are primate-specific genes. And so they've duplicated in recent primate history. And this is a fake heat map here, and you can see red is where they're expressed highly, and gray is where they're not expressed at all. These two genes have completely lost any overlap in expression. Mostly when you look at duplicates, you'll see some pattern of, in fact, if you look at the very recent duplicates, they're usually expressed very similarly, but they start to diverge really quickly. So we've got some cases of super recent primate duplicates where one copy has stopped being expressed in quite a few of the tissues that the other copy is. This is within human species. These are looking at two paralogs. These are looking at very recent paralogs lined up against each other. So this is a group of 10 paralogs that all come from the same source and of different ages. And some of the older ones are more similar to each other than some of the newer ones. So they're all under different pressures to diverge in expression pattern. So what we've done is we have, first of all, some of these experiments are done differently. We did them personally with RT-PCR, with carefully designed primers and so forth, northern blots with carefully designed probes from the 3' UTRs and so forth. But you can also go and take the microarray probes and do what we've done, which is to mask individual probes from probe sets that cross-react and look only at the unique probes and then ask what's that expression pattern look like. And when we do that, we see, for example, clusters, whole clusters of related genes where there's very little overlap in expression. Now, there are some clustered genes that look very similar to each other, but it's the exception rather than the rule. They seem to diverge quickly. Yes. Yes. We're just beginning to look at that, but there definitely is. So that's harder to do. There isn't a whole lot of data out there for individual humans. So I have a postdoc in my lab who's very interested in primate evolution, and she's comparing human and chimps and individual humans and individual chimps and looking for gene expression differences. And yes, there is expression divergence between us and chimps and between different individual humans. So, sequence divergence in neutral, in intronic sequences and upstream and downstream sequences and so forth, and repetitive elements that have duplicated along with the sequences. So. But they also diverge in DNA binding sequence, so they diverge structurally and functionally. And so to talk about that for a minute, let me back up for a second and tell you about how zinc fingers work. This is quite a simplification, but there's a lot of work that's been gone into this. Yeah. No. They can because they have open reading frames that encode functional proteins. We've probably personally looked at about 30, but that's it. Other people have looked at some others. We don't. There's a lot of proteins, and we just basically annotated them this year, so no, we have not checked them all. I mean, designing individual antibodies to detect these things. There are pseudogenes. There aren't very many. They tend to get lost. It's more likely that, so most of the pseudogenes are partial duplication events, and you can see that because some of them are super recent. So if we count just the very recent ones where we can do alignments along the non-coding sequences, we can see that they're just partial duplications. So they either just duplicated the fingers without the promoter or something like that, or the other side of the gene. There are pseudogenes, though. There are full-length pseudogenes in the genome. But other than that, I mean, we don't know they're all functional, but they're as functional as any predicted gene in the genome is, because we don't have proteins or known function for most of the 20,000 genes in the genome, right? So they're just as much real genes as anything that we're counting as real genes in the human genome right now. We don't have evidence for 90% of the human genes. They're making... Exactly. Oh, exactly. So one of the bits of evidence for why they're probably not just non-functional, I hope will come out as I talk a little further, and that's their pattern of divergence. They make proteins. We haven't knocked them out or anything like that. We're interested in primate-specific proteins, so we're doing siRNA and so forth. They don't kill the cells. Some of them do, but most of them don't. Overexpression sometimes doesn't make the cells very happy, but usually it's, you know, there's no, how can we tell if they're functional except that they're making a protein? We can design antibodies and detect a protein of the right size that goes down when you knock the gene down and so forth. Yeah. So yeah, these are early days in figuring out what these guys do, but I'll just announce that up front. We're just beginning to get into functional studies for these guys. It's tricky and really difficult to do the experiments because they're so similar to each other, as you might imagine. So, and because they are primate specific, and those are the ones we care about. So early days for figuring out what these guys do, but of course that's the point. That's what we want to get at. What's the consequence of all these new transcription factors and what's going on? So let's talk a little bit about the divergence in DNA binding sequences, which happens, as you'll hear from me, extremely rapidly and in extremely interesting patterns. So first let's talk a little bit about zinc fingers. This is the basic unit. It's C2H2 coordinated around a zinc ion. And the zinc ion holds the structure in place. So without that binding, you don't have a zinc finger. It won't bind to DNA. This is a three-dimensional structure, of course, but this is a nice little flat picture to show you how things work. There's an alpha helical region right here, which holds amino acids that are critical to binding DNA. And this has all been characterized very well for the ancient kinds of zinc fingers like SP1 and so forth that have been studied very, very well and thoroughly by quite a few people, Aaron Klug's group and Jeremy Berg and quite a few other people. So what they have found out by really careful, interesting studies, everything from crystallization to directed mutagenesis, is that the amino acids located in position 6, 3, minus 1, and also 2, which I'm just not drawing in here because it's the least of the four, and because it just to simplify things, but 2 is involved as well in DNA, in coordinating DNA binding. And these amino acids find themselves on the outside of the alpha helix in the folded zinc finger. And so you have these strings of zinc fingers held together with their alpha helix pointing up. It'll take a minute to load. This is from Carl Pabo's group quite a long time ago. And they studied crystal structure of DNA binding to these zinc fingers. And what they've seen is that what happens is that the zinc finger arrays, these tandem arrays of zinc fingers, wrap around the major groove of the DNA in a very intimate way and sort of lock into place along the alpha helix so that 3 or 4 amino acids here in the binding code match up with 3 or 4, and I'll tell you why, 3 or 4 sequences in the DNA sequence that they're recognizing. And the 3 or 4 is because there's some overlap between adjacent fingers. So it's not like there are 4 and 4 and 4. There's 4 with some overlap. So the net result is there are about 3 per finger. And what they do is they bind to sequences on the 2 strands by winding around the way they do. So very complicated interaction, but also very precise. And these 4 amino acids bind 4 nucleotides. It suggests a code, and of course there's been a lot of activity in trying to use that information to predict DNA binding specificities with some success, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. So how do these guys diverge? Well, they do 2 things. One is that if you look at a particular, so this is again this human cluster that I was showing you of related paralogs aligned with each other. And what's in the boxes are the identities of the three amino acids that are involved in binding. And so this is just to have a simplified look at what happens. So if you look at conserved fingers, what starts to happen is that there are amino acid changes in those DNA binding sequences. And what we've shown is that most of the, if you look at a zinc finger or a zinc finger protein and you ask, is it under positive selection or any kind of selection, the answer will be no. And that's because 90% of the finger is involved in this very, very highly conserved structure. Not under selection pressure, really staying the same. I mean, not under positive selection pressure. But if you look just at the DNA binding amino acids for any set of paralogs, if paralogous proteins, those are under positive selection for change. So there's a very there's selection for change in the identity of those DNA binding sequences. And we've published that. It's kind of difficult to detect because it's such a small piece of the protein. It's really hard to get statistics on the selection, but we've shown it and it does exist, and other people have since done the same thing. Well, you have to, first of all, some of these things have 40 fingers, and so you can look at quite a few fingers in a protein. You can look at lots of paralogs stacked up. Some of these paralog families have quite a few members. The statistics are weak because you would rather be looking at longer pieces of sequence, but you can detect a signal. No, selection is just acting on the paralogs. I can't say that it's under the same selection pressures exactly. I'm sure each set of fingers has got its own life. Its own history. Accumulated over a family of paralogs, yes. But if you even look at the super recent duplicates, you can see changes in those amino acids and those amino acids only in the proteins. So the ones where you can really see a lot of change are probably 20 million years old. That's pretty recent in mammalian history. If you look at things that are specific to primates, but early primates, there's almost no similarity between two sets of paralogs, with some exceptions. There are some that have been maintained as totally conserved to each other and have diverged a lot in expression patterns. There's basically any kind of pattern of divergence you can ask for going on in specific members of the family. They are definitely operating under different pressures, individual proteins. Yes. Very clearly. Very, very, very clearly. So, some do and some don't. Expression levels of what? Targets?
Yes.
Oh, we don't know what the targets are yet, except for a small number, and I'll talk about that. It's difficult to figure out what the targets are. Those are hard experiments. We're doing them, but they're not easy, and they're coming along slowly, and there are 400 of these guys, so we don't know it for most. That's the goal, though, is to figure this out. But there's another kind of divergence that happens with these proteins that's kind of unique to this style of protein, and it's not something you see typically, and it is driving divergence in this family faster than the selection of the amino acids, and that is the tendency for fingers to delete and duplicate. So we were talking before about how tandemly duplicated genes can form a structure that is has a high tendency to delete and duplicate through homologous recombination. That could be what's happening here because the zinc fingers themselves have, as I said, very, very highly conserved, very similar structural units, and very frequently the fingers within a particular protein from a group of proteins are related to each other by duplication originally anyway. So fingers will duplicate and then they look alike and then you can have all sorts of different rearrangements. We think this is happening too fast to be a legitimate recombination now, because we've looked at some very recent primate duplicates and it's happening really fast. And so we think it's probably more like a replication slippage mechanism, which has been described before in other species and other genes. Very similar sequences can line up, and you basically lose and gain sequences by very short alignments of sequence during replication. And so what we see, if we look at these groups of proteins, and this is this human group of paralogs lined up again, are fingers disappearing and fingers duplicating, the groups of fingers that are duplicating. And these are single mutational events that are making big changes to the protein. So we can see sometimes 5 or 10 fingers that are removed out of some of these longer arrays, sometimes right from the middle when they're arranged. So these proteins would not, no longer have the same sequence of DNA binding amino acids in them. And I'm going to talk about more about that as we go on. This is just to show you that even really, really, really recent species, within a species in this case, can show finger deletions. These are two inbred strains of mice for a protein called ZFP114. C57BLAX6 and 129SV have not been separated for very many years. They've been bred in the laboratory for about 100 years now. And when you line these proteins, you see the nice clean deletion of a finger. That's the hallmark of these kinds of rearrangements. They're nice clean deletions of whole fingers, so that when the protein zips back together, it has the same spacing. It's just missing a finger. So these are very clean events that just change the number of fingers. Up here in the spacer region, yeah, there are a few mutations. This alignment isn't very good. Sorry about that. This is a different. Yes. Oops. I'm sorry. Let me go back. Those are just substitutions. They're not deletions. I'm sorry. Yeah, those are substitutions. Those are just gaps in the alignment. This is just an alignment. This is the only real thing missing. Yes, it's just an alignment, and it's a little off. I can see from the transfer. See, this is just a. I'm sorry. No, it's not that horrible. But this is just S to R. This is a point mutation. No, there's quite a lot of polymorphism between mouse inbred strains. If you look at parts of proteins that aren't under selection, it's a long story, but the spacers are not under selection. If you look at spacers between orthologous genes between human and mouse, for example, there's almost no similarity at all. So the spacer regions appear to be not under selection to do anything except maintain an open reading frame. Think about the generation time, these mice. Yeah. Yeah. So think about a mouse generation. A mouse has a litter every 6 weeks, starting from the first, you know, the 100 years in mouse generations is a lot of human chimp years. Oh, it's probably 2, right? Something like that? Pardon? We're sure that this is the same protein, yeah. Yes. 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 Yeah, we've looked at that. We've looked at that, and this part is not supposed to be, but you know, we can't be absolutely sure. At very most, it would be about 1 million years because of the subspecies. But it's. Oh, sure. But there, let's just say that the rest of this cluster is from the same haplotype. And so this would have to be a strange double recombination event that popped out this single gene. And let me just say that we're seeing things like this in human and chimp. We're seeing like this, things like this in individual humans, deletions like this, okay? So it's not so far-fetched. We're seeing finger deletions and pretty significant divergence rate between individual humans. There are quite a few. There in the mouse, in the different mouse inbred lines, there are quite a few polymorphisms on point mutation level. Most of them are neutral polymorphisms. They're not really changing the function of the protein. They're changing this, but they're changing the amino acid. Well, so as far as we know, it is. But you know, there could be some influence from a strange double recombination event that makes this region very different haplotype than all of its surrounding. But its surroundings is from the same haplotype, and no mutations. So can we move on and talk about this later? Okay. You know, if I don't know if anybody in the room has ever looked at the mouse genetics haplotype data. There are a lot of SNPs and a lot of coding SNPs in the mouse inbred strains. Some of them are due to this, so the introduction. Yes. Yeah, it could be more complicated, but it's very. No, they're not. Of course not. No, they're definitely not. So, okay, can I go on? We can talk about, we can argue about this later, but all I could say is that if you look at the mouse mutation data, there are things, lots of things going on. As Shamil suggested, there are whole regions of haplotype differences between, that actually are subspecies of mice. They're the same species, they're subspecies, and they're a little bit older. They're not the same, they have a different lineage, and there's been some admixture, and it's possible this one is one of those things that got popped in by double recombination, so. So the question is, what do these finger divergence events do? Deletions and duplications within the array should put the fingers out of register with their target. And just remember that these bind in very intimately wind around the DNA. So it's very difficult for them, or at least as far as everybody I know who's experts in the DNA binding relationship between zinc fingers and DNA would say, it would be impossible for the thing to stretch up and find the DNA that's missing, that's looped out, for example, if it's got a deletion or a duplication. And so there's also the functional observation that subtle amino acid changes without finger deletions can also change the target choice. And here's an example, a pair of mouse-specific duplicates called RSL1 and RSL2. Very, very recent duplicates. There are something like 98% identical on the genomic level across the duplicon. And they have acquired some differences. The little stars are zinc fingers that have lost their C2H2 structure and can't bind DNA anymore. We call those dead fingers. They don't bind DNA. There's an extra dead finger acquired in RSL2, two of them relative to RSL1. But there are also two fingers that have changed in their DNA binding sequence. And it's known functionally that these bind to very different targets. So those little changes make a target difference in terms of function. They know that because they have mutants in these mice. in these two genes. Yes. Yes. Right. Well, we don't know whether final ones matter or not. Probably not. But as far as duplications go, yes. Yeah. I mean, duplications and deletions. As far as these kinds of changes go, we don't really know which the critical fingers are at this point, so we don't know what matters. All we know is that functionally, that when you knock these genes out in mice, they haven't actually been knocked out. There's a natural existing mutation in these mice that change the regulation of different target genes. And so even, no matter how similar they are, those little changes can make a difference in target choice. We have very few cases where we know this, but this is one case where it's known. So the ones, the DNA binding sequences that are known, and there are about 30 of them, let's say, maybe 20, that are known well. And I'm going to count other long zinc fingers, not just the crab zinc fingers, are on the order of 20 to 24 base pairs. Yeah. Right. You know, NRSF or REST is one of these proteins then, for which it's known. There are several other long, what we call them, polydactyl proteins that have. They have long binding sites, but probably they're not using all their fingers. There are 40-fingered proteins in this family, and the average is 12. And we really don't know the targets for most of them, so we can't say if it's generalization. The ones that have been determined have long binding sites for transcription factors. We don't know enough yet to say. So that's one of the things we want to try to find out by looking at different paralogs that have diverged in particular ways and finding out how that changes target choice. So that's basically. Probably not. That we don't know though. I mean, we're just speculating at this point, but probably not. So, yes, they can, well, that's a speculation, and there's some of them that do that, like CTCF. But it doesn't look to us, from the data we've got from the ones we're working on now, that's what most of them do. They seem to use the same fingers to regulate most of their targets, at least in a particular tissue. Now, we haven't looked in, 10 tissues or anything like that. But. So there's supposed to be, say, on average, 3 unique per finger. So that would be like 7 fingers or something. But like I said, the average is 12. So probably they're not using all fingers for binding. They may be using some of the others for protein-protein interactions or other things that we don't really understand yet. But there may be some of this alternative binding too, depending on partners, for example, that we don't understand. Sometimes there are ends, but not the ones that have been characterized are usually 21 base pair sequences. With some wobble, of course, there isn't a transcription factor there. Yeah, it seems to be so far, but we're talking about 20 proteins or so out of 400, so the jury's out on how these things interact with DNA, and that's one of the things we want to find out. Some are very well defined. NRSF is one of them. Some are very fuzzy, like CTCF. And, like I said, we have a handful, and we have pretty much every case. There are usually some variation in most positions. But so far, it looks like there is generally a favored binding site, at least the proteins we've looked at so far. So. We don't know that that's going to hold up. There may be whole groups of them that do, use half the fingers for one thing and half the fingers for binding with another partner or something like that. And we just, the jury is completely out on these guys. All we know is that they exist, and we're trying to figure this out. So, what's the impact on biology? You've probably heard some stories about gene duplication and what it does to biology. There's lots of cases in mammals of differentially duplicating genes. They affect our sense of smell, our social behavior, and all sorts of other things. So. What happens when the duplicating genes are transcription factors And so if these guys are all functional, are all binding DNA, their rapid duplication and divergence would apply an ongoing selection for change in invertebrate regulatory networks. And that is what interests me. Since each of these proteins potentially regulates hundreds of other genes, and that's about what we see when we go looking for targets, the cumulative impact of all this change in the genome should be huge. And so we really want to understand how that is happening. And I think to get a final answer on what the phenotypic impact is, we're going to have models that incorporate all the change you see in a particular genome, and that's going to be tough, especially since it's such early days on figuring out what any of them do. And so the challenge is that we know there are regulatory targets for almost none of them. And for a lot of the ones that I've described where we have a binding site, there's maybe only one target known. And that was pulled out through two hybrid system or something like that. So one question that comes up is the binding sites predictable? And you know, this 3-to-3 relationship has implied a code, and there are a lot of people working on this. There have been some good progress made on this problem. But the problem is complicated by the fact that the fingers other than 1, 2, 3, and minus 1, 2, 3, and 6 can probably influence what minus 1, 2, 3, and 6 do. So they don't always bind the same sequence depending on their context. And by some interfinger reaction, and possibly for deciding, you can't know by looking at a 40-finger array which fingers are required for binding. So you can't just align them and say these fingers are conserved, so they're probably involved in binding, because that's not the way it works. Most of them aren't conserved. So they may use different blocks of proteins, and there are a couple of examples of that. And so what we need to do is just get out and determine targets for a number of them and try to see if we can figure out some of the rules. And so just really, really briefly, we have pulled together lots of different experimental methods, including TET-regulated expression of transgenes and tagged proteins in cultured cells, siRNA knockdown, chromatin immune precipitation. We've designed antibodies to as many of these guys as we can, and looked to see what happens when we up or down regulate the genes, and then compare that with what we see on chip. And there are some procedures that work better than others depending on the protein you're looking at. RNA knockdowns and chip works really well with the ancient proteins. Yeah. Yeah, we're doing for the primate specific ones, we're doing cell lines. We're also working on some proteins that are conserved, or let me give you an example in a minute. Some of them are sort of conserved but have been lost in one lineage, and that's one group that we've worked on quite a lot. And then we can look in animals and look in tissues. But otherwise, we're looking mostly in cell lines. We can get our hands on human primary cell lines, for example, that are derived directly from tissues and grown in a dish for a few generations, and we can do things like chip and knockdowns in those cell lines. And we have done some of that, and it's better than working with really long-established cell lines, but it's a tricky business because they're not the cell lines aren't settled down, they're changing with lots of passages, and you have to be really careful how you handle them. We could do some of this in vitro, but it's really, really tricky. These proteins are not easy to express in vitro, so we've had a really hard time doing that, and everybody I've talked to has as well. And it's also questionable whether determining binding sites in vitro will really tell you what's going on in vivo, and so we're mostly focusing on in vivo binding assays where we can. Yeah. Yeah, so the conserved ones, there are several phenotypes associated with the conserved ones. A lot of them are embryonic lethal, the deeply conserved zinc fingers. They're mostly natural occurring protein, not mutants, or they're gene traps, or a few of them are knockouts. Well, there are several examples. Some of them are, there's several reproductive mutants. There's several, so they don't breed. They have no sperm or something like that. There's one that affects skin. They have a skin disease. There's another one that is, most of the rest of them I know about that are, most people have worked on the conserved ones, and they have mostly been embryonic lethal. Well, the one I told you about with RSL1 and RSL2, they have different, they have very subtle phenotype. They have different, so RSL means regulator of sex-limited expression. Males and females express real genes very differently, and that's because they are differently regulated, and these genes are involved in that process. So they silence, they themselves are expressed on the, under the influence of hormones, and they shut down genes in one gender but not the other. And that's what that whole family of muscle-specific proteins do. That's the kind of functions these guys are involved in. Things that are under heavy selection, like gender-specific traits and that sort of thing, and reproduction, and immunology. They're involved in immunity and functions that you would expect rapidly evolving genes to be involved in. And a lot of those, you know, you can knock them out. They're not, you know, keep it in a cage in a sterile house. It's not going to do anything to the animal, but they do have effects in the wild, and they do have effects if you study them closely enough. But the very recently duplicated ones usually have some overlap in terms of function with some of their neighbors, and they probably cover for each other to some extent too. So it's very hard to be sure exactly what's going on with those. Like the RSLs, they're really probably, they're 98% identical in the non-coding regions. So they're very, very, very new. So what I'm going to talk about really briefly, because I know I'm running out of time, is a particular class that we have focused on because we're interested in the process and because they're easier to study. But they're still really interesting from the point of view of duplication and divergence of genes. And so these are a particular class of zinc-fingered genes that are imprinted. And for those of you who don't know about imprinting, let me just give you a really quick buzz through. So imprinting involves the specific silencing of the allele you inherit, either from your mother or your father. So we all carry two alleles, of course, and one is silenced and the other one is allowed to be expressed. And this is a really specific type of regulation that's under a lot of study. If you upset this process, you get diseases like Beckwith-Wiedemann syndrome and Prader-Willi syndrome and lots of other ones that usually involve problems related to early development and growth. This differential regulation involves DNA methylation marks that hit one allele and not the other, and it's set in the germ cells before they come together. And long-distance regulatory mechanisms that are not completely understood that can co-regulate groups of genes that live together. So imprinted genes usually live in domains. It affects about 100 or 200 genes in the human genome, something like that. It could be a little bit more. And the functions of those genes are pretty specific. There are some outliers, but usually they're involved in fetal and neonatal growth, nursing and neonatal feeding, for example, glucose metabolism and things like obesity and diabetes, and social behaviors, including things like maternal caring and mate choice and inter-animal aggressiveness, inter-male aggressiveness in particular, response to novelty, and some people are finding links between autism and imprinting as well. So social behaviors are a big thing that are affected by imprinted genes. Another thing that's really, really common is placental development, and this interaction between fetus and placenta is a really complex and interesting phenomenon. It's a very unusual relationship that involves lots of changes in both the maternal and the fetal structures. And placental imprinting is the least conserved part of all these genes. Most of these genes are pretty conserved, but the genes that are involved in placental imprinting are changing a lot, and that's possibly because implantation in different mammals is a very different process, and especially between animals that have big litters and animals that have small litters like us. So I'm going to talk about one particular group of imprinted genes that are dominated by zinc fingers of this crab zinc finger type. And this is a cluster that we have been studying for many years, and we've discovered most of these genes. I've just color-coded them. If this is paternally expressed genes, and that means the maternal allele is silenced. This is a maternally expressed genes, which means that the paternal allele is silenced. And so these clusters, this is kind of typical. You'll have both maternal and paternal silenced genes in one region. And somehow this is all coordinately regulated. That's what we don't understand, and it's one of the things we're interested in looking at. So this is the human cluster. It has a series of zinc finger genes. This is what the mouse cluster looks like. Instead of this group of four, we have one mouse gene, and we know that these are primate-specific duplicates. so they're very recent. They're not super recent. They're present in rhesus, for example, so they're relatively old primate duplicates, but they're not seen in other animals. ZNF71 is gone. It's been lost. There's no trace of it anywhere in rodents. ZIM1 is lost in primates. And this gene called ZIM2, ZIM3, and ZNF264, which are perfectly functional genes in humans, are pseudogenes in rodents. So there's a lot of change, even though the sequences are still there and the structure is there and they're all imprinted and so forth. There's a lot of change in this cluster. If we look at dog, it's sort of a composite of the two, and this is why we know that, for example, ZIM1 is an old gene that was lost in primates, because dog has it and so do other mammals, and primates have lost it specifically. ZNF71 is there in dog, and that's why we know rodents have lost it, and so forth. So the genes are perfect, beautiful open reading frames in dog, and just rodents have decided to kill them off. So what's going on, and this is a nice little mini system to study how one group of genes can come and go and diverge and change. Within a functional realm that we understand, these guys are all involved in placenta, or they're all expressed heavily in placenta and embryonic brain. And so they should be potentially involved in similar pathways, and it gives us a little bit of an enclosed capsule to study some of these phenomena. And so we've made antibodies too and done studies on four of these proteins, which I'm going to talk about really, really briefly and whiz through. One of them is LNL765. Let me go back and show you where it is right here. This is a gene that's not in the annotated databases as a gene right now. We annotated about, well, it was published in April, and it's still not in the databases. But anyway, there are four genes here. One of them is this one that I'm going to talk about. It's the one that is the closest thing to an ortholog. In fact, we're pretty sure that it is a functional ortholog of the extant mouse gene. And so in mouse, the expression is, this is an in situ, this is a sectioned thin section of a mouse embryo stained with a probe, and you can't see it very well with the lights on, but this is a staining red where the gene is expressed, and it's mostly in heart, in the alveoli of the lungs, in certain parts of the brain, and in some parts of the condensing bone. So the red is where the gene expression is. You see these little dots in the lung, that's the alveoli of the lungs. So it's highly expressed in the embryo and the placenta as well, and it's in adults it's basically turned off except in the testis. The mouse gene is imprinted. We haven't had a chance to test the human gene yet, partly because it has four paralogs that are very similar, and it's really difficult to do the studies. When we do our combination of siRNA and overexpression and et cetera, we get 32 really frequently and regularly downregulated targets, including one of its neighbors, ZNF71, and a real classic set of imprinted genes that is pretty much the first group of imprinted genes to be described, H19 and IGF2. Repression, so when you overexpress CFG1, ZNF71 goes down. When you use siRNA, ZNF71 goes up. And so this gene is repressing ZNF71 and other ZNF genes. And what it looks like to us is that there's a complex network of interacting proteins we're just starting to uncover and discover, but there's a lot of interaction between these guys. ZNF71 targets and other genes that are affected in the transgene experiments are involved in angiogenesis, wound healing, vascular development, and placental function. And when we've made transgenic mice with CFG1, and it has placental defects. So when you think about these guys, so one allele's being shut off, when you wouldn't think that would be held as a conserved function or as a, all mice have this gene silenced in one allele, unless gene expression levels was an important thing. Having two copies of this thing on is not good, and that's generally true for the imprinted genes. We are overexpressing it. Yes. Yes. Under controlled Cre teton expression. And so we are, we haven't knocked it out, but we're going to do something equivalent soon, which we'll be able to study what happens when you knock it down. But we're going to make a dominant negative fingers only construct that should block the real transcription factor from binding to its targets. And we just haven't finished that yet. But when we overexpress it, we have obvious problems with the placenta. So it is involved in placental function, and even though ZFG1 itself doesn't bind to anything that is known to be involved in placental function, it binds to this protein, and its targets are clearly involved in placental function. So, and in particular in angiogenesis, which is really important in fetal invasion of the placental wall, they have to form blood vessels in order to tap the mother's bloodstream and get nutrition. And they're very invasive, aggressive things, and that's a process that's really, really important to implantation. Also vascular development, and that's really interesting with respect to the expression pattern of the gene in heart and vascular tissues. So one of the other proteins we've studied is called SIM1. This is the one that's missing from primates, but it's also missing from bovine. It's present in pigs and rodents, and so it's possibly involved, or there's possibly some relationship in the adaptation to singleton births. So you think about cows and us, we both do the same thing. We have different kinds of placentae than mice and pigs that have litters. So that's our working hypothesis anyway. It's expressed highly in placenta and in the brain and muscle and heart of embryos. And a placenta binds about 30 major targets, including a really interesting class of proteins called the major urinary proteins, which are famous for being pheromone carriers. It's a big family, and they don't know what all the family members do. Some of them are expressed in placenta, and those are the ones that are bound by this guy. And they don't really know what the function those are, but they're called lipocalins. They carry signaling molecules like pheromones. It binds to the promoters. Right. Right. Binds the gene regions and shuts them down. So it binds to promoters of and silences some really interesting targets, including somatostatin, IGF-1, and IGF binding protein 1, all of which are involved in fetal growth and placental interactions. And when you have defects in these genes, they lead to problems with implantation, including some of them are involved or thought to be involved in a condition called preeclampsia, which is a really serious problem in fetal maternal interactions that is a very, very serious issue for lots of women. And so these guys are all implicated in that pathway. So this is also another one. The interesting thing about the major urinary protein genes is this is another big family of genes that only exists in rodents. MUPs don't exist in other species. So we have odorant binding proteins, which are from the same general class of genes, but we don't have any homologs of the major urinary proteins. And so the fact that we don't have this gene is interesting in that context. We don't have ZIM1 and we don't have the targets either, but we have some of the targets, so. Oh, well, it's a major target in the sense that it's a very high probability binding site on chip, and it goes up or down depending on what experiment you do when you manipulate ZIM1. They're the outstanding high p-value results you get when you mess around with that gene. Another one, I'll just really briefly go through this. This is an in situ of a tissue. There are tissue cores from humans, so basically a piece of tissue is fixed, a core is made, it's put into a block, and then the block is sliced, so it's a thin section, and you can stain with antibodies. So this is the way you can look at tissue-specific expression in humans. And why do this when you have microarrays? Well, it's interesting because you can look to see the cell types that are actually expressed. And in particular, this was interesting to us. This is cerebral cortex down here, which looks blue. The red is the signal, and it looks like there's no expression. But if you zoom in on the section, you can see these little dots of glowing bright red. And what it tells us is that there are very specific neurons in the cortex that are expressing this gene. And that's interesting because when you go to look at the targets for ZNF264, one of the things that comes up is neuroepithelial development in the cortex, which is something we didn't expect. So this is one that's conserved in most mammals, but a pseudogene in rodents. What that means yet, we don't know, but that's what we're out to try to figure out. About 60 high probability targets involved in neuroepithelial development, especially in the cortex, and uterine development, fertilization, and pregnancy. And so what we're trying to figure out now by looking at the concert of all these genes changing They're all interacting and impeding, interacting in some of the similar pathways that we see some overlap between targets of some of these genes. They are related to each other ancestrally. They're old duplications, but they are related to each other, all the genes that are in this cluster. And we see a mix of things like the PSG proteins, which are another family that are very lineage specific. It's a family of pregnancy specific glycoproteins involved in placental development that is present in primates but doesn't have any obvious. It has functional correlates but not homologs in rodents. And the rodents have something called the CEA family, which is probably doing similar things but not ancestrally related in the classical sense. So these are families that are duplicated and divergent on their own in the different lineages that also seem to be regulated by these guys. But there's also targets that are deeply conserved, and I just want to mention one set that's coming up in the cross hatch of a lot of these different proteins, and this is the family HOX8/9-13. And so these are homeobox proteins. They are deeply conserved. But these guys, this particular group, has changed in its functional, in its actual biological function with vertebrate evolution. So these guys have a major role in male and female reproductive development in basically every vertebrate you look at, and also in invertebrates. In mammals, though, they've acquired new adult roles in involved in the changes of the uterus in its evolution to become an organ for implantation and carrying of young. And this is something that I didn't study. It's been very well characterized by several authors. And so some really nice review papers on this. This is an ancient gene that has really, really changed what it does in biology. It maintains a role in reproductive development in chickens, where are they? In birds. It's involved in the oviduct development, which is a very different thing than the male mammalian uterus, but it's the analogous structure. So it's a little bit, in some ways, like what's happened to PAX6 in terms of controlling eye development, but not the same kind of eye, except that these are involved in a little bit more downstream processes, and so it's not just turning on what will be an eye, but deciding what kind of eye it's going to be. So these genes also show a strong signature of adaptive evolution, and even though they're very deeply conserved genes, they've undergone some really interesting changes in mammals. And I'm not an expert on this subject, but anyway, these genes are popping up one after the other as targets for the various genes in our imprinting cluster. And so it's very interesting with respect to their role in placental development and uterine expression in the uterus, and something we're interested in trying to make sense of. So the summary to date is we have preliminary data on about 20 proteins just from our lab. Others are in progress. We've focused on the imprinted zinc finger genes, some primate-specific duplicates. We don't have enough data on those for me to really tell you what's going on, but we've looked at several paralog pairs where we've got big deletions or duplications in the fingers, and we want to know what the outcome is. Human copy number variants. So these genes that are the primate-specific genes are heavily represented in the copy number variants that have been reported by various people. For, I think, obvious reasons, they're doing what they do in evolution, except that since they're very recent, they have a higher tendency to recombine and lose and gain copies. These show up very highly represented, especially some of the newer higher resolution copy number variant studies, and also some that are known to be related to cancer. They repress a lot of different kinds of genes. They're involved in some of the older ones are involved in metabolism. A lot of the newer ones are involved in reproduction. That seems to be a common theme. A lot of them are involved in immunity. They're expressed very highly in immune tissues. And a lot of them are involved in development, even the more recent ones, which is really exciting and interesting to me. Other proteins, including other members of this family, are frequent targets, and so they seem to be interacting with and regulating each other. It's something we don't completely understand yet, but those guys show up as targets of each other very frequently. And the lineage-specific genes are implicated in pathways that are known to vary between and within species, including immunity, fetal development, including neural development, and gender-specific traits, for example, which is a pretty interesting target for rapidly evolving proteins. Most of the things that we've looked at so far regulate small numbers of genes that make sense with respect to their long binding sites. So, and the genes that are changed when you over and under express these guys tend to focus themselves in particular pathways. So they're not all over the place. They come together. They cohere into functional pathways pretty frequently, which is satisfying and interesting to us. But to really get a handle on what's going on and what this is doing to evolution and what it does to individual traits and so forth, because we also know that these are varying between individual humans in both structure and copy number, we're going to need a bigger picture. I don't think it makes any sense to look at one or two genes and say we have the answer to what's going on, because they're certainly interacting, probably covering for each other to some extent. And so I think, you know, the answer on what's going on in evolution will require a lot more data and some really serious modeling down the road. And so that's the big challenge. One of the things we're really interested in doing right now is looking at proteins like this little group, which, since it has a mouse paralog, LNL765, and its little imprinted family, we can do things with the mouse that give us a handle on the biology. LNL765 and its mouse paralog share finger sequences, but human paralogs of LNL765, which are in rhesus but probably diverged just before, right around the time of the divergence of old New World monkeys, have changed their finger sequences extremely in the DNA binding domains. They're very similar proteins on all other levels. We have a really hard time designing specific antibodies to them, for example. We have been able to do that for some of the more diverged pairs, but the fingers are really different. So they have diverged to bind to different DNA sequences, but with some really interesting overlaps and patterns. And so this kind of what happens when you change a few amino acids in a finger or a few fingers in a finger array is the kind of thing we want to get at. And so we're starting with targets like this where we can really wrap our hands around it because they're relatively short and related to each other in some interesting ways. So in the end, one of the things we want to look at is what happens between species. We're seeing some really interesting differences between human and chimp genes and between individual humans that look like duplications and divergence in very recent paralog pairs. And so we have quite a lot of differences of this type in human and chimp paralogs. We confirm that by resequencing and so forth. And we want to know, is there a related change in the binding sites or change in the protein function, or no functional change at all? Maybe some of these differences don't make a difference. Maybe what really matters is what's right here or what's right here. And that's the kind of thing we want to try to figure out by messing around with these proteins. We can work in chimp cell lines and human cell lines and see if they regulate similar things and et cetera. So the implications, the regulatory targets are known for just a tiny fraction of the transcription factors in any species. Probably yeast is the only exception to that rule. And not all regulatory pathways are conserved. There's a lot of individual lineage-specific gene regulation patterns going on. And mammals are not unusual. I just told you this wild story about what's going on in mammals, but we should think about the nuclear receptors in nematodes. And Drosophila has expanded a family of zinc finger genes, very similar to the crabs, except they've attached a different kind of domain, a different repressor domain onto the N-terminal end called the ZAD domain, and expanded that. That's insect-specific. It's not seen anywhere else. The fingers don't look like anything. They have no homologs in the human genome. And Xenopus has expanded a big family called Fax as well. And this is happening in all lineages, and why? What does that mean? And what impact does that have on evolution? I think it's not an isolated case, and I think these groups of lineage-specific transcription factors that are seen basically in every, plants have this too. They've taken another family of zinc fingers and stuck something else, another effector domain onto the end and expanded them. And those are plant-specific transcription factors. So this isn't an isolated case. It's happening basically in all lineages. And so then I just wanted to thank my group and point out in particular Stu Huntley, who did most of the annotation, Aaron Hamilton and Alice Yamada, who were involved in setting up and designing and getting going all this experimental stuff that is pretty tricky because of the way these proteins work and so forth. Dan Baggett is a informatics guy right there who built our database and was really involved in identifying the proteins and doing the evolutionary studies, and the rest of my group, so thanks. so there's a group of them that have a domain, an association domain called the scan domain, as well as the crab. And those guys are almost certainly forming protein-protein interactions and binding together. And they, as a group, have shorter finger arrays than the crab ones. And so, both, yeah. And it's possible that some of the crabs do that with part of their fingers, and again, they may be recruiting cofactors or other binding proteins. And actually, we have some really interesting binding site data now that makes it look like some of our crab are interacting with other transcription factors, other zinc finger transcription factors that are known ones, conserved ones. And so we don't know exactly what that means yet, whether they're actually stuck to each other or just sitting next to each other, but the binding sites are next to each other in the genome with really, really high frequency. So. Jury's out because we only have data on 30 of them, you know, so, but we don't know yet, but the things like NRSF seem to bind to DNA by themselves, and that one's studied pretty well. It binds to DNA by itself. It recruits other cofactors to do what it does downstream, but its binding is singular, and it has, I think it's 9 fingers. It's kind of a typical polydactyl protein, and that one's been studied to death. CTSCF also seems to bind by itself, but interacts with a lot of proteins to recruit cofactors and so forth for function. So the ones that have been studied seem to bind by themselves, but that doesn't mean they all do. If you look at mammals, that's true. They pretty much all have similar numbers of proteins, so there must be, it's not true, like birds have quite a few fewer, fish have quite a few, I mean, frogs have quite a few fewer than the mammals do, but all the mammals have something on the order of 300 to 400 genes, so it doesn't seem to be any particular, since all the mammals are not, they don't have the same set of genes, you would expect some differences if there was. Yeah, they seem to be lost pretty frequently by deletion mostly.